Okay, so I'm going to be talking a bit more about xenon isotopes because I can't stop, and what they can tell us about the history of volatile recycling. So we're going to try to look back in time, and this is work that I've done with Sujoy over the past couple of years. So some of you have seen this a couple of times, but just for people who haven't, there are 9 isotopes of xenon. There's only one element with more. Anyone know what it is? Tin. Tin has 10, and if you ever go to a really nerdy trivia night, you'll win. Tin has 10. And of the 9 isotopes of xenon, 4 are considered primordial. These are not produced in significant amounts by radioactive decay. And so the budget of the primordial xenon isotopes is what the Earth has had since accretion. Xenon-129 is produced by decay of iodine-129, which has a half-life of 16 million years. So after 90 million years, the system is extinct, and you cannot produce more 129 xenon. And then these 4 in my fission bubble here are produced in distinct characteristic proportions by the fission of plutonium-244 and uranium-238. So plutonium-244 is short-lived. It has a half-life of 80 million years. So that's about 400, 500 million years of sensitivity in this system. Uranium-238's half-life is about the age of the Earth, so approximately 4.5 billion years. And so this is still producing the fission isotopes of xenon. And so in previous talks, we've sort of focused a bit more on what iodine-produced xenon can tell us about ancient heterogeneities in the mantle, and the sort of takeaway that I want to reemphasize here was that we'd showed that from measurements of plume-derived basalt and mid-ocean ridge basalt, you had heterogeneities in the 129 xenon signature, which had to form within the first 100 million years and could not have been erased over the subsequent 4.5 billion years of mantle convection. So this was an early formed heterogeneity that was not subsequently erased. Today what I'm going to talk about is that long-term processing history and what we can say about the cycling of volatiles from the xenon isotopic signature of the mantle. All right, so I apologize, there's going to be some intermittent numbering of slides. These were slides taken from an AGU talk, so they are in order, but then there are some unnumbered slides. So xenon is degassed from the mantle. This is my very colorful schematic diagram where nothing is to scale, but there is a mid-ocean ridge that is sampling the upper mantle, and then a plume environment where perhaps a lower mantle reservoir is being sampled. Noble gases are lost from the mantle in association with partial melting at mid-ocean ridges and hotspots. And then if we focus in on the subduction zone, subduction zones were long thought to be very efficient barriers to the recycling of noble gases, and particularly xenon. However, recently, some work on continental well gases and mantle-derived basalts has shown that noticeable quantities of atmospheric xenon must be recycled into the Earth's interior in order to explain the composition of mantle basalts. And so if I kind of sketch this timeline of Earth history that's sort of blown up at the beginning and squished at the end. If I have my accretion process, where you have accretionary impacts, including giant impacts, culminating with the moon-forming giant impact, and I have some early Earth with an atmosphere in place and a little moon, and at some point that settles into a plate tectonic regime where there is degassing in association with partial melting and regassing in association with subduction, or downwelling. So on the degassing end, our constraints are coming from iodine xenon for the early Earth. Plutonium xenon, it's extinct at about 500 million years, so it's sensitive to early processes, but also the beginning of perhaps this long-term processing regime. And then uranium fission xenon, which is an extant system, meaning it's still producing xenon. On the regassing end, the point that I would like to highlight is that the regassing of atmospheric xenon is potentially very isotopically interesting, because the composition of atmospheric xenon is isotopically distinct from mantle xenon. You cannot form atmospheric xenon just by simply outgassing what's in the mantle. And it seems to be seems to have changed over time. And so some recent studies of Archean rocks show that the atmospheric xenon isotopic composition evolved over time. So this is the start of the solar system to the present. And this notation is just saying this is a measure of mass fractionation. So in per mil per atomic mass unit, what is the mass fractionation relative to the present day? So zero is the present day value. And these are data from a collection of studies of either Archean cherts or fluid inclusions in quartz separated from Archean cherts. And what they're showing is that 2.5 to 3 billion years ago, there was a distinct atmospheric composition, and there seems to be a diminishing mass fractionation in the atmospheric composition over time, perhaps reaching the present day around 2.5 billion years. And so there's a diminishing mass fractionation compared to the present day.
Rita, are there observations that constrain the constancy of the xenon?
Over here, there's a new study from Avis, I believe 2018, where he has more data points. Usually there were at least a few, right? Yeah. And they seem to confirm that after about 2 billion years ago, we reached the present day. So this sort of raises an interesting possibility. Can xenon isotopic evolution of the atmosphere be used to constrain the timing of atmospheric xenon recycling? All right. So with that in mind, we can start by testing n-member scenarios. So what we had already done, or our previous approach, was to say we have the mantle xenon composition today, and we can model that as a mixture of modern atmosphere, radiogenic and physiogenic xenon, and primordial xenon. And if you're trying to come up with some linear combination of those components, and we're plotting the sum of squared residuals for a given sample in a sort of Monte Carlo way, for the salts from the equatorial Atlantic and then well gas from Bravo Dome, these are both sampling the upper mantle, you're able to pretty much recover. If you have a sum of squared residuals of zero, that means you have perfectly recovered the mixture that you're trying to make with your four components. The composition using modern atmosphere as your atmospheric end member. If instead you were to use ancient atmosphere, so mass fractionated atmospheric xenon, as the only xenon composition that you can mix in linearly to get your present day mantle, you always end up with high sums of squared residuals. What this is reflecting is that you can never actually get today's mantle xenon composition if you're exclusively recycling ancient atmosphere. And so just as a first scan, that tells you you had to have some amount of modern atmosphere mixed in. But it's possible that you had a mixture of the two of these over time. And so this is a first pass, but we'll try to improve on that.
Yeah. Is that real data?
Yes. Wait.
That's a lot of data.
Oh, sorry, no, this is, so like Monte Carlo error propagation. So yes, so it's equatorial Atlantic depleted more, but one mantle source, and then given the uncertainty in that, do it 10,000 times. Yeah.
How do you know that the xenon that you measure, for example, in the equatorial Atlantic depleted more, isn't just like contaminated by modern atmosphere?
So I went over this in previous talks, but I didn't put any slides here. So we're correcting for shallow atmospheric contamination explicitly. We're looking at neon argon and neon xenon, and we're correcting to a mantle neon stable isotope or primordial isotope ratio. So that's to correct for whatever atmospheric contamination has happened after eruption. So these are mantle source compositions, meaning they've been corrected for shallow contamination. Okay. All right. So I put together this little sort of box diagram to get us thinking about xenon in the mantle over time. So if we start off with a box of some primordial budget at the beginning of the Earth, and primordial is in purple, I'm going to add xenon through fission ingrowth. So I've added plutonium fission xenon in yellow, uranium fission xenon in red. Recall that the plutonium fission xenon is produced by a short-lived radioisotope. And then I'm going to lose xenon through degassing. So this little step, just a whole bunch of the xenon went away. So the one thing that I want to point out at this degassing step is that if you have concurrent degassing and ingrowth, you're going to affect the plutonium-uranium fission ratio. Because as you continue to degas, you're losing all isotopes of xenon, but eventually plutonium goes extinct. And so you'll only grow back, you'll only grow in uranium fission xenon. So more degassing means a higher proportion of uranium fission xenon, lower proportion of plutonium fission xenon. So then if I add one more arrow to this diagram, I have regassing of atmospheric xenon into the mantle. And then if we're thinking about concurrent degassing, ingrowth, and regassing, the sizes of these different arrows are going to affect the mixture of primordial atmospheric and fissionogenic xenon that we end up in with the present day. Does this make sense? Okay. So here's a schematic of our model. We have two boxes. We have the convecting mantle, which is the mantle source of mid-ocean-rich basalts, and an atmosphere box. The atmosphere box is essentially an infinite xenon reservoir that has an evolving isotopic composition. So from time step 1 to 2 to 3, I have three slightly subtle shades of blue to indicate the evolution of the atmospheric xenon isotope composition. In my convecting mantle, I start off with some primordial budget of xenon, and I'm going to be processing it by partial melting, so my outgassing arrow is reflecting partial melting of some given mass of mantle. So we have a processing rate history, meaning there is we've pinned the present day processing rate based on mid-ocean ridge processing rate, and then use an exponential function to describe processing rate over time. And so you can change the exponential constant, time constant, to give a different processing rate history. And so we've parameterized it so you can say I had a processing rate history equivalent to 9 mantle masses processed over Earth history, or 6 mantle masses processed over Earth history. So if I say NRES equals 8, that's what it means. The number of reservoirs processed over Earth history was 8. So I've covered that. The concentration of atmospheric xenon in the downwelling, so this is my corresponding mass of downwelling to offset the upwelling mantle, is also going to change over time. And then you could look at that and be like, but how do you know that? We'll get there. So we don't know that, but we can guess. We can guess a lot of times. What else do I want to point out? The other thing I want to point out is that the colors are sort of meaningful. So you start off with your primordial sort of reddish mantle, and as you're degassing, maybe that would become pink as the overall xenon concentration decreases. And then as you're regassing more, perhaps it becomes a bit purple as you add blue into the mix. So a couple of the initialization details. We assume an initial mantle xenon-130 concentration that corresponds to 0.1 to 1% mass late veneer with CI chondrite concentrations. We're going to test many different downwelling xenon concentration time series. And then, as I said, there's an exponential mass processing rate tied to the present day ridge rate. And so how do we determine whether our model was successful? We want to find a mantle xenon-130 abundance that matches our estimates for the present day xenon abundance. And then we want the xenon isotopic composition of the mantle, specifically a ratio of two primordial isotopes and then the fission xenon isotopes, that falls within the range determined for the mid-ocean ridge basalt mantle source today. And so, any questions on this? Yep.
How important is the assumption of an exponential?
It's not that important. So we tried a linear, didn't change the overall result. We tried a constant, and it was sort of nonsensical.
Well, so I guess with the system, you're very sensitive to the very early Earth. Is that correct?
Not necessarily. Okay. Yeah.
So why did the linear not work? Why did the constant not work?
We couldn't get enough mantle processing to explain the plutonium to uranium fraction. So you need to degas enough to explain that ratio, and you're always too undegassed.
But you reverse the process? Instead of starting at the initial stage and running 10,000 models forward, could you just start today and go backwards?
So this is why I asked Ved what this is called, forward modeling, to solve the inverse problem. I assume that you could try to solve the inverse problem the normal way. I'd love to talk to you about it. Yeah. Okay, so when I say we can just try a whole bunch of xenon concentration time series, this is what I mean. So this is over Earth history, the concentration of xenon 130 and downwellings over time. And we chose a sigmoidal functional form because it's kind of nice and versatile. So this is showing a class of sigmoids with a given rise time, a constant rise rate, and different final values, all the way up to an upper bound of what's estimated for slabs today. And what we can do with this shape is we can say, okay, give me a whole bunch of different examples with different rise times, different final values, and then the last thing you can do is you can stretch it sideways. I didn't show this here. So the rise rate can be changed. And so you can end up with things that approximate a linear function because you're sampling a sigmoid over a discrete time interval. You can end up with things that look kind of exponential, but aren't strictly exponential. And you don't need to have, say, a finite grid resolution. We approach this with a Monte Carlo so we could kind of test a whole bunch of characteristics. And so I'm going to show what happens if you have three different example xenon 130 concentration and downwellings over time. And I'm going to show the path that this will trace out on this xenon-xenon isotope diagram. So the things that I want you to keep in your head are that the modern atmosphere is here, and the modern Mohr mantle is in this gray field. And we think the primordial atmospheric composition is this approximately this orange square. It's called U-xenon, which is very confusing. It's not uranium xenon. It is unfortunately named Ur-xenon, like the primordial xenon. And it was shortened to U-xenon. Anyway, so there's this mass fractionation trend going towards modern atmosphere. So the atmospheric composition at any given time is along this trend, but constrained by those data that I'd showed earlier. For the mantle composition, it starts at average carbonaceous chondrite, and following some path that will reflect the addition of fission xenon, instantaneous recycling of atmosphere, and degassing, you will hopefully end up somewhere in that Mohr mantle field. So I'm going to take away the labels, and then I'm going to show you the traces produced for one, which is a history that rapidly rose and stayed at a high value over Earth history, two, which was sort of a moderate rise time and moderate final value, and then three, which has a very late rise time and a low final value. And so these are color-coded by rainbow according to time. So they all start at the brown diamond. And for scenario one, you pretty much immediately just swing right over to the atmospheric evolution line. You have swamped the mantle with atmospheric gas. And so you're just going to follow what the atmosphere is doing over time. It's a similar story for number two. Spent a little more time heading towards fission xenon as the plutonium and uranium decay. And then you swung over to the atmosphere evolution point. Yes?
You say there were some constraints on what the current downwelling is.
On the current downwelling?
On what the current concentration in the downwellings are. You said there was some maximum that was constrained by observations.
Yes.
So how come they're allowed to end at completely different points?
So there's a maximum that's allowed going into the subduction zone. But then that subducting slab is subjected to higher pressures and temperatures. And so you would lose xenon from the subducting slab, so it can be anything up to that point, including zero. Yeah. Okay, and then number three, where I have no ingassing, no regassing, no regassing, no regassing. My mantle composition is starting at ABC, average carbonaceous chondrite, and then it's just shooting up towards the fission xenon composition until regassing kicks in, and then I swing back around towards the atmospheric composition and end up in this gray field. And so if I do this over and over and over, testing a whole bunch of different functions, what does it look like if I collect just the successful scenarios? So it looks like that. And the first time I did it, I was like, oh no, there are no successful solutions. And then I blew up the y-axis and I squinted and I was like, oh wait, there are some. All right, so the main takeaway point is that for successful realizations of this model, we have minimal xenon 130 in downwelling materials until about 2.5 billion years ago. So this is color-coded according to its final value. So the darkest blues are the ones that will eventually have the highest present-day xenon concentration, and the light blues will have the lowest. And so the trade-off that you can see here is that for the realizations that end up with a relatively low present-day value, earlier rise time works out. For the darker blues, the concentration of xenon in downwellings has to be near zero until very recently.
So on the previous plot, where was your 3 intersecting the y-axis?
So this 3 is the dark blue line.
Okay.
Here. So what changed at 500?
What changed at 500?
Yeah.
You could equivalently say what changed it to 2 billion.
Not really. It's just a little... Biddle.
Oh no, so we can't comment on whether this is more valid than this.
Yeah, but this still bends around in the end.
The line models have been further than the 0.5.
Oh yeah, so there were some that rose after this, yes.
And go even
higher, yeah, and they don't work.
So, but even the ones that are sort of deviate from 0 to 2 billion years, they eventually curve over, right?
So they're flattening.
Oh, they will stay flat.
Yeah. Okay. So it's a sigmoid, so it's going to hit its carrying capacity and just stay there. Yeah. If you do it with an exponential instead of a sigmoid, it looks very similar, and you cut out those early sigmoidal rises and then flatten. Okay. So if we then look at the same set of successful solutions and look at the xenon concentration in the manifold over time, it's... degassing, so it's losing xenon over time. And then as you start to have non-zero xenon concentration in the downwelling, then you shift towards net regassing fairly late in Earth history. So the solutions indicate that the mantle shifted from net degassing to net regassing after 2 billion years ago, some point after 2 billion years ago.
Very recently.
Including potentially 500 million years ago. Yes. Okay, so I'll take you through 2 conclusion slides. The first one just about xenon, the second one taking this one step further. So we're leveraging an information-rich system. So the plutonium and uranium xenon is giving you a constraint on the extent of degassing over time. And then the atmospheric isotopic evolution is telling you about when you can have regassed xenon coming into the mantle. And we are finding that significant recycling of atmospheric xenon cannot be tolerated prior to 2.5 billion years ago. So potentially downwelling conditions, it could be the pressure, the temperature, the composition of what's subducting, changed at that time. The mantle transitioned from volatile degassing to regassing after this time. And then if we think about what phases carry xenon in subducting slabs today, xenon is carried in downwellings and associated with hydrous minerals. So serpentinite, you could look at the xenon abundances in sediments or altered oceanic crust. If we take the distribution of xenon abundances in successful time series, so going back to this diagram, if I just say at 3 billion years ago, take this set of successful xenon concentrations and use the H2O xenon ratio of a high H2O xenon lithology like serpentinite, then you would get on average 0.61 ppm H2O in downwellings, where the 95% bounds are 0 to 62 ppm. So that's very dry compared to the estimates for the modern day subducting slabs, which would be 400 to about 1,000 ppm. So that means that Archean downwellings would be dry compared to the present. So unless the primordial mantle was very dry to begin with, this means that the Archean mantle was drying out over time because it would be degassing and having that material replaced with very dry material. And so our last sort of point here is that progressive drying of the Archean mantle could potentially lead to slower convection and decreased heat transport out of the mantle, and then you could have a non-monotonic thermal evolution of the Earth's interior. So with that, I'll take questions.
freed up. This is really nice, but I'm a bit confused about using the water to xenon ratio, because water is part of the mineral structure.
Yes.
Xenon is not. And so there's no, I can't think of a reason why that ratio should be constant.
So the the analyses that have been done on materials that were, what's it called when it?
Exhumed.
Exhumed, yes. suggest that if you had xenon trapped in, say, fluid inclusions, you were actually retaining xenon preferentially to water, so you could have a dried out residue of, what's it called, hydrous mineral breakdown, that still had a high xenon content. Yes, dehydration. And so one possible explanation for this was that H-plus was diffusing out of the fluid inclusion and leaving xenon preferentially. So it's possible that you may drive water out, and it would either carry xenon with it, in which case they're coupled, or potentially you would leave the xenon behind. So we think the sense of it is still giving you a constraint, because if you were to squeeze the water out but leave the xenon behind, then it's an even lower amount of water that you could take with it. Does that make sense?
I don't know.
Okay. Let's talk more about it.
Okay, yeah. Let's go.
So you chose this sigmoidal path, which never allowed the xenon rate to ever, the slope to ever be negative.
Yeah, so I actually did try parabolic as well. So it could either decrease over Earth history or decrease and then increase. Yeah. And we end up with very similar results. So you end up with things that are near flat, so maybe a little bold, or things that increase very late.
Okay. Have you ever just tried random paths?
I did. It was not that illuminating.
Is that saying something then?
I'm not sure, because what I didn't try was random paths that started at different values. I did random paths that started at zero and kind of walked up or stayed at zero. Yeah.
So it was first.
If you make these inferences for water and European pencil, do you not also have inferences for the present day? Because your final, like, xenon measurement down is very, very low compared to the maximum amount we've estimated.
Yes. So we did do a sanity check. So if you were to carry it all in, say, sediments or all in serpentinite, could you still end up with a reasonable water flux today? And for, I believe, all of the parameter space, it's yes. I'll double check it, though. That's what you're saying, though, right? It has
yeah,
to.
Yeah, because it was so small compared to your maximum prediction, right? So
yeah.
So much lower.
The response to that is that the maximum prediction was not all within the limits of what would work for the water cycle today.
Okay.
Yeah.
Isn't the last sentence inconsistent with the assumption about processing, where you had like some sort of decrease?
Yes, I would say so, probably. So John Crowley did this model with the CIDR 2010 group.
For example, I mean, yeah. Just like including the feedback, volatile rheology feedback.
Yeah, so that's not in here. We have just assumed a monotonically decreasing processing rate.
Rika? Mm-hmm. So perhaps this shows my ignorance of petrology, but if you have a hotter mantle in the Archean, you actually get more crust, right? And thicker crust or more melting actually leads to drier basalt overall, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of just drying the Archean mantle because of degassing, couldn't it just be showing that you have thicker crust in the Archean?
Thicker crust in the Archean.
Thicker oceanic crust, I should say.
So,
I think that the overall, greater degrees of partial melt generally mean a drier package.
Yes. So,
right. Isn't that true?
So you're saying a drier crust that when it gets to a subduction zone is dry because it was a high degree partial melt?
Higher degree of partial melt.
So I think that gets canceled out because this is a concentration. So if you have the per gram, I'm not sure. I have to think about that.
Me too. Actually.
But
I mean, the water that's presumably getting recycled is because of the interaction with the hydrosphere, right?
Yes.
Surface and then it goes down.
Right, it's not intrinsic crustal water.
So it's not stuff that's in the mantle.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So,
Do you assume instantaneous mixing in the mantle reservoir?
Yes. This is assuming instantaneous.
If there's a relatively recent change, say 500 MA, that's not very long relative to a whole mantle mixing time scale. Yeah. So can you comment on the potential effects on the inferences that you make?
I had written a paragraph in the manuscript and I forgot what it said. So if I try to reconstruct it, it was something like, if you did not have instantaneous mixing, the water that you took down would not be immediately available for outgassing. And so what you would do... So the argument that I was working towards then was about ancient regassing. But the point that you're making about if it's in the last 500 million years, then is it instantaneously mixed? Yes, that's a good point.
Yeah. But if it's the last 500 million years, you might actually preserve some of this ancient hydrogen. But the fact that we haven't really seen it yet might argue that the regassing actually started earlier.
Yes, but...
Not 500 million years, but maybe more towards like 2 or 200. Right?
Sure. So in the scenarios with the light blue, where you started regassing 2 billion years ago, I think that will still give you the present day value mixed in. So maybe what that would let you do is say those dark blues with the very late mixing are not actually going to give you an upper mantle homogeneous composition like what we observe, and therefore is actually earlier. Why didn't we do that?
So in your model runs, your final solutions are all very low compared to this maximum value that you could have. So can you just comment on, I understand like that it doesn't always need to be this maximum value, but you have no cases where it's the maximum value.
Yeah, so that maximum value, the distinction that is important to make is the amount of xenon that's going into the subduction zone and the amount of xenon that's being regassed to the mantle. Okay. So that the slab is going to release a large proportion of its volatile budget as it goes to higher pressure and temperatures.
Okay.
And so what this is showing is that you did not have a very high efficiency of recycling. You had a relatively low efficiency of recycling, assuming that you started with something like that in the initial slab.
Great, thanks, Rita.
Yeah.